You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello and welcome to episode 38 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Mathilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a tea which is known as Kaminfeuer, which is German for like fireplace, which when I looked at it, I was just intrigued. And it's delicious. It's like a fruity one with lots of cinnamon and everything. Very, very nice. I feel it's not really appropriate for this really sunny day, but anyway. And joining me on my tea break today is Alexandra Sabir, founder of Solemnico and all-round power woman. So welcome, Alexandra. And what beverage are you drinking today in your break?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on. It's so lovely to chat to you. And I am drinking Apple Moon Tea by Bookham's Curiosity Shop. So had the coffee and we're now on to the tea.
Apple Moon Tea. Is that like with, is it mainly apple or is it like other little things coming through?
It's mainly apple, but I think it's also got some like citrus in it. And then it's, I think it's got some kind of rosemary or something, but I'm probably butchering their ingredients. But
so apologies calming. If you're listening in.
I'm so sorry. I totally butchered.
It's very good though.
Imagine. But no, it's very calming, very like, also, I love the fact that it's got actual chunks of apple in it.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I can still remember when I first discovered like proper fruit teas and things. Yeah. And you're like, oh, it's not just like infused black tea. It's
literally.
Which are you like, are you a common drinker of sort of more fruity teas and herbal teas?
I wish I was. If I'm perfectly honest with you, it's like a once in a blue moon kind of thing. I'm mainly on black coffee and then water. But then like if I have like an extra 10 minutes, like I did before this call, I'll be like, right, we will get out the proper teapot, the proper teacup, and we'll do it properly because it's a proper ritual, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
I think
so. Yeah, more of a coffee girl, but yeah, I love, as I think I said when you came on my podcast, like you're the reason that I have all this tea. So I blame you for
I take full responsibility. Yes, indeed. I'm going to be putting it in the show notes, but if anyone wants to hear me chat with Alex about other things, you can listen to her podcast, the Solemnico podcast, but we'll get to that later. But in terms of coffee as well, you mentioned sort of ritual. I mean, which, yeah, we spoke about the word ritual on your podcast.
Sorry.
And its relevance to archaeology. Ritual buzzer. But coffee, for me, I've recently started sometimes drinking coffee, and that for me is also a nice little ritual because I have the little, what's it called, cafetiere thingy.
Oh, love that.
Everything, which is also very nice. But when you say black coffee, that sounds to me like I have 2 minutes to get my black coffee and go. Yeah. Okay. All right.
It's a lot less aesthetic than a cafetiere. If you like instant coffee, we'll just bung it in, no teaspoons, just pour the hot water on and let's go.
I mean,
it's not
fair.
Very healthy.
Well, but do you find that you are able to take kind of, I mean, we're taking a bit of a tea break now, but how often do you kind of take a break during your working day?
Oh God, if my mother was here, she'd like hold her head in her hands. I take an hour for lunch. Even that, sometimes it's like a sandwich on the hoof. But it kind of depends what day I'm doing stuff, but definitely take the dog for a walk and then, yeah, try to have a lunch break. So at least like once during a working day.
I mean, that's fine, right?
Yeah, that's sustainable.
Well, the reason I ask, because as I mentioned before, you have indeed founded kind of a small business. You have a lot of other little projects on the go. What is it? I mean, this is probably a very complicated question for you. When people ask you, what do you do? What's your kind of elevator pitch? Like, how do you describe yourself?
Yeah, so yeah, because of all the little projects, like I think trying to use umbrella terms. So like I always say I'm a business consultant, kind of specializing in working with solopreneurs and creatives, and then also a bookbinder, specializing in making luxury stationery that's also sustainable and ethical and blah, blah, blah. And then from there, if they want to know more, then it's kind of like one of those family tree things where it's like, we'll start with the top.
Like pick your own adventure. Which path do you want to go down of my very complicated life?
Yeah. It's like one of those kind of questionnaires in magazines where it's like, do you want to end up as like, you know, the full moon or the half moon? And it's like, oh, I kind of wanted to be the half moon. So we'll start from the top again. So yeah, business consultant and bookbinder, and then with various little like twigs coming off.
Things in between. Yeah. Which, I mean, that's, you know, It's indeed, it's all sort of one package. And like you say, it's all interlinked, even if it's sort of branching out to different spots.
No, definitely.
But what was the root, if we're sticking with the tree metaphor? What was the first seed that was planted that kind of made you decide to start down this path?
Yeah, it was definitely like, I think when I was quite young, I suddenly realized that you could get paid for doing what you loved. Like you didn't just have to do like the 9-to-5 office job. And that for me was like total mind blow. I was like, oh my God. And like the first time that I got paid for being a proofreader, that blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, I feel like I'm, you know, twitching the system because I just got paid to read a book. And from there, of course, being an utter book nerd, I really wanted to be a writer. And then because I think we both know that that's quite a convoluted situation. So then, yeah, went into bookbinding and it's kind of just grown from there. And then the business consulting is my bread and butter. And it's also just really interesting meeting other business owners and kind of getting to know how they run their businesses and helping them. So yeah, sorry, that was probably a really long answer.
No, that's fact. That's what we're here for. That's the point of a podcast this is the point where we're allowed to ramble and people will listen. That's also, that was something that blew my mind at some point. I was like, wait, people want to listen to me rambling about random stuff? For those listening, by the way, who are wondering, where do we get to the archaeology part? Don't worry, it's coming. It's getting there. Yeah. Again, it goes back.
Please don't tap out.
We're going to go back in time at some point. But yeah, I always just like to find out indeed a little bit about the kind of background of the people who I talk to, because indeed on this podcast, the aim is not just to have archaeologists, not just focused on archaeology, but to look at kind of the crafts and the traditions that have kind of continued within archaeology. But then you mentioned sort of other small businesses as well, sort of the business consulting. I mean, I can imagine you also work with a lot of other people who are involved in, I don't know, more traditional crafting or more sort of unorthodox ways of working, shall we say.
So,
what's sort of the most exciting thing you find about that work? Like what's some, I don't know, some nice insights, nice tidbits into the things that you do?
I think it's just that like you literally can get paid to do whatever it is that you enjoy.
Yeah.
Like people do the most niche things and are doing it very successfully with a really strong but a really strong loyal audience who want what they are giving. So like no matter what you love, no matter what you do, there is an audience out there. You just have to find it, and then within that just kind of like you can make it work for you. If you hate social media, you don't have to do that. And you know, I think that's the biggest tidbit is that no matter what you want to do or how you want to do it, you can.
Yeah. Which I think is also really interesting in relation to, now I know you're not an archaeologist, but I feel like there's a lot of the times when you're studying archaeology, you get to the end and you think, I don't want to go and dig, or I don't want to work in a lab, or I don't want to do this. And like you said, there's still this assumption, I think, with a lot of jobs and a lot of kind of career paths that if you don't go on the kind of standard traditional career path, then you're not, you know, you can't call yourself an archaeologist. But I imagine there's probably a lot of skills. I mean, I don't know if you have any examples from your own life or from people that you've worked with of kind of very careering career paths.
No, 100%. I think like certainly in my world, the biggest one is art. So being an artist, and you probably have the same with archaeology. There's this kind of almost snobbery around like, are you doing it for the money? Like, are you a commercial artist or are you an artiste?
And it's like,
and like, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with doing things for the money. You know, we've all got to pay bills. But yeah, like saying that you do is, yeah, like there's nothing wrong with kind of going down a more commercial route or a less kind of, you know, going with the art thing, doing exhibitions, things like that. You know, you can do it however you want. So I guess that's the most linked one that I can think of.
Yeah. Which, so speaking of, you know, going however you want. So you mentioned already you sort of, you were interested in writing and you kind of started that off. But I mean, what was the journey? Because this is me, by the way, asking a very leading question, because I know that you have done so many things in like the lead up to Celebrico and all of that kind of stuff. So what was the kind of the other projects that have done and how did that lead you to getting to the point where you want to help others in business or where you want to create this this luxury brand?
No, totally. I mean, yeah, as you say, lots of projects probably that like Jesus Christ. But yeah, so,
all, though, so we're putting the link to all of them in the show notes, so you go check them out, everyone. But
thank you. So yeah, in 2020, I think it was just as COVID began, actually, happy days, that I started the How We Came to Be projects, and that was like Salemnico hadn't begun then, but I always think of that project as the founding stone, which sounds so dramatic, but it's true.
We are archaeologists here. We like founding stones.
I mean, if anyone's going to get it, it'll be you guys. And that was, so I basically read an article about the Syrian conflict and what was going on with the women and the girls, and it made me want to do something, but I was like, you know, I'm not a reporter, I'm just this teenager in the middle of Dorset who can't do anything. And then I was like, yeah, but everyone's got their own story, everyone's got something that happened to them, you know, whether it's grief, whether it's, you know, relationships, things like that. And so I started publishing and taking stories from people. It was a very safe space, it was just run by me, so, you know, and it was a non-for-profit. And basically, yeah, I ended up collaborating with NGOs, charities, communities across the world. And it really showed me the power of storytelling, I think, and the power of letting people have that safe platform. And I think from there, again, the love of giving people a space, whether it's a notebook or, you know, a card or something to tell their story. And yeah, just making sure that Salemnico is always there for other people and for, without wanting to sound like one of those people, kind of for the greater good, you know, it's trying to be as non-selfish as possible.
I mean, I think you say trying not to sound like one of those people. If one of those people is someone who's trying to do good in the world, I think you should try to sound like one of those people.
Yeah, because... exactly. Sorry. louder.
Well, but it's nice to see, because that's also something I think a lot of archaeologists feel, is that, you know, we look at things that are happening in the past and all this kind of stuff, and there's that feeling of, oh gosh, what are we actually doing for the world? Yeah. How can we help the world? But it's nice to see that an example of something that, you know, a notebook shop, basically, right? Like, but then the story behind it has this deeper meaning and has this understanding. So I think it's a nice example to show people of how you can, even just with the smallest thing, still make some difference and feel like you're doing something, you know, for the planet.
Thank you. Yeah. No, it's true. And yeah, like everyone, like I think, sorry, I'm rambling, but we're talking.
Like I said, podcast, pointless ramble.
I think, you know, I'm sure you have this in archaeology as well, but like, I feel like society tells us that not one person can do something big, but I think the one person definitely can. And if you're wanting to do it for the right reasons, then yeah, just do it, kind of thing.
Oh, well, this is a very deep start to a little light, fun, cozy podcast about archaeology. And now we're talking about how we can save the world. So, you know, I think this is a good point to take a little quick break, top up our tea, have a breather, and we'll be right back, everyone. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Hope your teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So I didn't just get Alexandra to come and join me today on my tea break to chat about how she's saving the world and her work and the planet and all of that kind of thing.
I wish.
So I wanted to pick her brains on the topic of bookbinding to continue with the kind of theme of the last few episodes and the next few episodes about the kind of everyday archaeology of the home. And we're looking at the moment at notebooks and books and those kinds of things. Because I feel like everyone has some kind of notebook or book or something lying around on their desk that they're looking at in the moment. And as you mentioned, Salemnico is now kind of a luxury notebook brand with various accessories and other things that are branching off it. But bookbinding is a topic. I mean, what was it that kind of first drew you to that particular craft?
Yeah, I'm going to be totally honest with you. It was reading Inkheart by Cornelia Funke. So,
which is an amazing book. So
exactly. So Cornelia, darling, if you're listening to this, thank you. Because if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't
read. Maybe if you're listening to this, feel free to send me any kind of copies of books I can promote on the podcast.
Amen to that. Me too, please. But yeah, so reading that, and then there's a character in there called Mo, and he's a bookbinder. And like reading those descriptions, all of that, like I was very young when I read it, and I didn't realize, I mean, because it's a fantasy book, I didn't realize it was a real job. And then I found out it was. And I was like, oh my God, this thing is real. I could be Mo. So yeah, that's how it started.
And I mean, in terms of bookbinding as an actual craft then, I mean, you thought it was a fantasy job. Is it still quite a well-known craft? Do a lot of people still do it?
Yeah, so it's definitely well-known within not trying to be offensive here, but within the older generation. So chances are that they'll have done it at school, things like that. But younger generations aren't so aware of it, which is a shame because it's a beautiful craft. Mm. I think also part of the issue is that, especially in the UK, there's no standalone accreditation. So it's basically up to private binders to teach and carry on the craft. Is also quite an expensive thing to get into. Like if you're really wanting to become an accredited bookbinder, it can cost hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
Right.
But yeah, in Europe it's a bit more recognized. So like in Italy, they'll have like apprentices, things like that, which have died out within the UK. We now only have internships at private binders. So it depends which country you're in and how old you are, I think, on whether you recognize bookbinding and know its value.
Yeah. Which I think there's quite a lot of it. Actually, one of the things offered by Solemnico is the Notebook Club, which has the annual subscription box. And the theme for this year is endangered traditional crafts, which I guess their bookbinding is an is it classified as an endangered?
No,
not even. Okay.
No, not yet. It was, thank God. But certain aspects of it are. So like four-edge painting, which is where, you know, when you like the cover's usually very old, very leathery, and then the edge is usually gilded in gold. And then when you spread it out, there's an image.
So not when it's just shut, but when when you sort of make a little hill from the almost. Okay. I didn't realize that's what four-edge binding was. I thought that it was just painting on the side.
So it's like a very specific way of doing it and where it looks hidden. And then when you, as you say, make a hill
and spread it out,
then yeah, you can see it. And that part of bookbinding is now endangered. So certain aspects of it are, but bookbinding itself, I think, because across the world there's so many private binders and there are quite a few guilds to do with it.
Okay.
Yeah, which is good. So yeah, it's not yet endangered. Hopefully it won't be, but aspects are.
Yeah. Okay. And so did you do an apprenticeship of some kind? Did you teach yourself? How did you learn about bookbinding?
So I decided to do a beginner's course in it. So I went to the Southern Book Crafts Club, which is based in Winchester, near me in Dorset. And I did a 6-week course on just the basics. So learning the bindings, learning how to make a notebook, learning how to kind of do certain variations. And then like it's very mathematical bookbinding. And as we both know, I am not the most mathematically inclined person. And so then I was like, I don't want to do any more courses. I will just teach myself. Mm. So I took what I'd learned. And now if I'm stuck on something, I use YouTube. YouTube is amazing. Mm. Or Pinterest, but you can do full-on internships, things like that. So that's how I got into it.
Okay. And what would you say we'll get into the sort of the tools and the practicalities in a moment, but in terms of the sort of, I guess, the mindset or the skills or the sort of, what would you say is, what do you need to have mentally in order to kind of prepare yourself for doing bookbinding?
I think honestly, a passion for books, like you have to love notebooks, books, and be a little bit nerdy already about paper. that helps. But also I think being aware that it's not an instant gratification craft. You know, it takes time. It's very repetitive. You have to be quite patient with it. But that's basically it. You don't have to be, you know, a wizard, GSM knowledge and things like that. Just, an adoration of books and a drop of patience, really.
Yeah, which I always find that interesting, looking at kind of traditional crafts, because that's something that we do a lot, of course, in archaeology as well, because quite a lot of the time you have the physical remains of something, but in terms of actually seeing how things were made and how things were done, you have to look at then the sort of traditional crafts that then still survive in the modern day. And one of the main things that is always sort of commented upon is, I guess, this pre-industrialization, that sort of idea of, look, it doesn't matter if it takes time and it doesn't matter if it, you know, you need to redo things or things like that. Yeah. So I suppose that's a very different perception compared to
I think it's healthier. It's certainly lower blood pressure kind of requirements, isn't it?
Yeah. And I guess the problem is, especially if you're trying to do something like that, like a traditional craft, a slower craft, shall we say, mm-hmm. in the modern world, which is used to this capitalism and capitalization in big letters because we're very angry. Capitalism. Is it difficult to kind of show people the value of what you're doing? Or do you find that quite a lot of people still understand the value of traditional bookbinding?
I think people understand the value of it, but I think there's this really fine line between like people understanding it, but people don't want to pay for it, which I understand. You know, I'm a child of the 21st century. You know, you have Amazon, which sells, you know, £3 notebooks that are made in batch in a factory using staples. You know, it's hard when it comes to showing people why it costs so much and why it's better than maybe cheaper versions, but it's an interesting one.
We'll put it that way. No, it's one of those things because I feel like a lot of people that I've spoken to before on the podcast as well have talked about that, how, you know, you have to go so niche and you have to really show that, look, it's not just the end product that's the important part. It's the whole aspect, which is also something very interesting archaeologically, known as the chaîne opératoire, where you're basically looking at every stage in the manufacturing part of an object. So I find that personally very interesting.
No, definitely. Me too. If I was at all academically inclined, I can definitely see that. Yeah.
Well, and so on that topic, so in terms of the kind of actual process of bookbinding, I mean, you said, you know, you taught yourself, you do things. So I guess you don't need like a massive studio or anything like that. I don't know. What do you need in terms of tools?
Yeah. So bookbinding itself is actually pretty like inclusive as a craft. Like all you need is a needle, an awl, which is like the really sharp, stabby thing, a bone folder, but it's nowadays made from plastic or from wood, a special bookbinding needle, which has a thicker needle point and then kind of tapers off to the top, and then waxed thread. And yeah, like all you need is enough space to fold some paper. I work at my parents' dining table because I moved back home to begin Salemnico. Mm. So yeah, it's very like democratic and inclusive as ancient crafts go, I think.
Well, and it's really interesting that you say all these things and it's that this was made from this, but now is made from this. Do you sometimes find that you see, I don't know, objects used for other things and you think, well, that could be useful in bookbinding? Or, you know, do you find that there's a lot of...
No, 100%. I mean, you know, with the Notebook Club theme this year, like, it's definitely showing me that, like, notebooks are so, so amazingly inclusive when it comes to, you know, design and, you know, just embellishment and how you want to lay it out and everything. And, you know, you can use whatever you want, which is amazing. It's great for creativity. So yeah, it's pretty much just make it however you want. Once you've learned those basic skills, you can do anything.
Yeah, which I do love the designs that you're coming up with. And that every time I open the new notebook, so I am a subscriber to the Notebook Club. And every time I open a new notebook, I'm like, what is this? Such a unique design.
Oh, you're so sweet.
But where do you get the sort of ideas for the designs from? Are there kind of set, I don't know, notebook styles that are sort of very traditional? Yeah. Or are there also historic ones that are kind of have been developed further? Or how do you get inspiration for those?
So I mean, there are definitely historic ones that have been developed. So originally, bookbinding originated in East Asia. I think my geography is also terrible as well as one math, so bear with me. But so yeah, lots of the designs which we now know, such as, you know, the with the lock on and, you know, the kind of the board folding over the edges and things like that, those are originally from the Middle East and, you know, East Asia. So yeah, it's design wise, you can take things that were used in ancient times, you know, the illustrations found in religious texts, things like that, and you can modernize them. For me, I love being a bit wacky and just like with them, the last Notebook Club notebook was kilt making. Yes. And so just looking at how do you make a kilt? How do you do that? And then kind of going, well, I'm using cloth for a notebook, so why not make it into, you know, kind of parody how people make kilts? So yeah, however creative you want to be, you can be, and you can use any material really to do that.
Yeah, Yeah. No, I find that really fascinating. And for those who are interested in hearing further about the history of bookbinding and notebooks, don't worry, we're going to get into that in the next episode, which is coming out in 2 weeks. So don't worry, we will get into that. But I guess it's kind of a final question before we stop for today. In terms of, you know, we've talked about as well today, you work with a lot of small businesses, you're engaged with a lot of traditional crafts and everything. What would be, if you would have sort of the one, I don't know, message that you'd want to send out to people about traditional crafts, or, I don't know, to try and make people more aware or encourage more people to engage with them? What would your sort of advice or your inspirational pep talk be for that?
Yeah, definitely. Like there's so many amazing crafts out there, and unfortunately so many are becoming extinct, but they are all linked to their environments, they're all linked to communities. And I think to go back in and revive these crafts, it would have so many positive outcomes. And that's not me just preaching, I do truly believe that, but also it's just really interesting. So go on Heritage Crafts, have a look, there's so many cool crafts, and there are loads of people doing courses. You know, you don't have to become a professional, but just giving people who practice these space and time, that is so valuable. So
That's good. A good pitch, I think. Hopefully it's inspired some people listening to take the plunge and take up that traditional craft or look into it further. I think we might be running out of time on this particular tea break, but do not worry, everyone. There is going to be another one coming up in 2 weeks where we'll be chatting further with Alexandra all about the history and the sort of background of bookbinding. I hope that you enjoyed this tea break. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Also, don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topics of today's episode or about Alexandra's work and all the links that we mentioned, you can find all of that as well as our contact information in the show notes. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.